Talking NBA Finals, KD, trade rumors, NBA draft, right now with Tom Haverstraw. We got a champion. What a wild game. Thunder win this game 7, 103-91. Tyrese Halliburton, torn Achilles in the first quarter of the game. That's going to be a major story to discuss it all. Tom Haverstraw. Tom, how you doing?
Hey, it's great to be here, Kev. What a game. What a season.
What a season. I know. It's all over. I mean, Jalen Williams said it on Saturday ahead of the game. He's like, it's a weird, eerie feeling knowing that this is the final game. And this is actually my first time covering a game 7 of the finals ever. And it is a weird feeling. And yet here we are entering the night. We know it's the last night of the season. I'm hoping it's going to be an all-time great classic game down to the wire with moments that we remember. And we did get some moments we remember just in a different type of way, because at 16-16 in the first quarter, Tyrese Halliburton takes a step, lower leg pops, slams his fist on the floor because he knew right away it was a torn Achilles. And Indiana bounces back from that. They're actually up 1 at halftime, but OKC in that third quarter suffocating that Indiana offense minus Halliburton, 34-20 in the third quarter, to push the lead all the way up to 22 in the second half. 5 steals in the third quarter alone. Tom, I felt like from the OKC side of things, winning this championship, their first one in Thunder franchise history, it all came back to what made them such a bullish choice to win the championship in the first place. And that was this dominant defense. Yeah. And we saw it show up in that second half.
Yeah, like 2 weeks into the season, I called them the OKC Dobermans, not just because they were, you know, barking in their post-game interviews, but because, you know, this is what Phil Jackson called Scottie Pippen and the rest of the wing defenders on those Chicago Bulls teams. Is there were Dobermans out there, Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, that they get after ferociously defensively. And you see that with the Oklahoma City Thunder from the get-go, with Alex Caruso added to this team for Josh Giddey in the offseason. Sam Presti has been a brilliant executive as the steward of the Oklahoma City Thunder ever since the Seattle Seahawks days. He has been masterful in how he has built two dynasties in the making. I'm going to call it the James Harden, Russell Westbrook, and the Kevin Durant trio was a dynasty in the making. We know how that ended. Of course, it got broken up a short time after they went to the 2012 NBA Finals, but they continued to, in a small market, thrive. One of the best teams over the last two decades in the NBA. Now they are finally crowned an NBA champion. And, you know, like, that defense is crazy. They did it all season long. And in this game, they scored 32 points off of turnovers compared to the Indiana's 10. And that was the formula all season long. Oklahoma City Thunder, what they did to opponents was turn them over, demoralize them, and score the other way. And Indiana did such a good job in the first 6 games of this series, kind of stem the bleeding. I called them the tourniquet earlier in this season, just how they were able to just cut off the bleeding and make sure they were able to, you know, get back in transition. It didn't happen in this game. And ultimately, the Oklahoma City Thunder are the 2024-25 NBA champions. And I gotta say it, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander was awesome tonight. 12 turnovers. I mean, sorry, not 12 turnovers, 12 assists in this game, just one turnover. 12 assists was a playoff high for him. There's only 2 other players in NBA history that have done 25 plus 12 assists in a game 7 in the finals. Those names, Jerry West and Walt Clyde Frazier. So he is down there with one of the best finals performances we've seen, averaging over 30 points per game. And they did it with him playing great defense and also the team, Chet Holmgren. Just, this was a team built on an absolutely dominant defense. And this is what fans want. They want defense. They want physicality. And OKC did it this season better than anybody else.
Yeah, and you mentioned it with SGA. It wasn't just scoring for him. He has 29 in this game, 27 shots. Kind of have a throwback style inefficient game for like your star players. SGA 8 of 27, Jalen Williams 7 of 20, but that's the way it goes sometimes in the postseason. Historically, if you look back at numbers from a Kobe Bryant level type player, one of the greatest players ever, a lot of games in the postseason where you're shooting 35-40% from the field because that's what the game demands. And with OKC in this game, they win scoring only 103, give up 91. They shoot 40% from the floor, 27% from three, 71% from the free throw line. That's a testament to that defense that you're talking about, Tom, and SGA being a part of that. He has not been, as far as we know, recording this live, named officially Finals MVP yet. But with him, part of it is defense in addition to the offense with what he provides. And I thought he gave everything the game needed, especially in that third quarter. He had a stretch where he hit a three-pointer. He made these two beautiful passes, especially the one, I think, to Jalen Williams for a 9-0 run. Part of the reason why OKC built that lead in the third quarter, where I was just like, SGA is just in the zone right now. He's just seeing the floor well. It felt like OKC in that third quarter. Because I'll tell you what, in the first half, Tom, I felt like they just felt like they were more negatively impacted by the Halliburton injury than the Pacers themselves. The Pacers felt completely unchanged to me. The Thunder, I watched them, I'm like, are they like more down about this? Their energy seemed lower. They were not being the assertive team. It felt like they didn't have a killer mentality. And then in the third quarter, they did adapt that, SGA being a part of that. But man, that it was just a weird game because of that Halliburton injury. He is having a great night, 9 points already in the game of 16 points at the time for Indiana. He's playing aggressive. It just sucks, man. It sucks that he got hurt. And like, that's part of the story tonight. It's just part of it. Injuries are part of the story with this game tonight, part of the story with the entire postseason as a whole. So in that sense, I guess it's on brand. Just a bummer. Like, I feel so bad for Halliburton, man. I feel so bad for that dude.
Yeah, I was there when Kevin Durant tore his Achilles in the 2019 NBA Finals in Toronto. It was game five, and he had a similar incredible start to the game where you're just like, how is he doing this? Similar injury coming into the game, a calf strain, what was labeled a calf strain that was knocking him out for weeks in that postseason in 2019, comes back in game five, just killing him out there. And then does the same kind of try to push off that ankle, yes, and it just ruptured Achilles. And it's just so hard to watch. I winced every time that ESPN went to that replay when you could see the recoil and they kept showing the slow-mo. It was hard to watch, but I get it. This is the NBA Finals. The star player, Tyrese Halliburton, is down with an injury, slamming his fist into the ground. And my wife was in the room, my father was in the room, and they were just like, they couldn't believe what they were watching. I was screaming. I was like, no, not in the NBA Finals. In the same way that in the 2019 NBA Finals, we saw not just Kevin Durant go down, but also Klay Thompson game six with the ACL injury. And this is the NBA Finals. These players are being pushed far past what their bodies are normally capable of. And that's what we love about sports, right? We think that there's a capacity that these guys can hit, and then they go even further. And look, Tyrese Halliburton has been dealing with this calf strain, ankle injury that he called it, kind of a nebulous injury that wasn't totally clear what was going on, but he fought through the injury. And then ultimately the same leg snapped his Achilles, from what it seems like. I should say that we should couch that. It's not official that it's a ruptured Achilles, but this is something that has been a real epidemic in the NBA. Third time in this postseason that we've seen a star player, Jason Tatum, Damian Lillard, and Tyrese Halliburton go down with a ruptured Achilles. And then you throw in the fact that this is the third time that the Pacers have had a player go down with a ruptured Achilles in Isaiah Jackson and James Wiseman. This is a crisis. Like, you can say that this maybe one of these or two of these, it just happens. But when you're seeing several players this season go down with an Achilles rupture with the same kind of movement, that push off, the classic push off, where that ankle is totally flexed, right there with Tyrese Haliburton trying to push off. This is something that I don't think is something we can blame the Pacers for. The fact that they've had three of these this season when every team, it seems like, is dealing with something similar. And it's something that the NBA has to figure out. Like, bar none. We have to figure out how to stop this right now.
It's not just the Pacers, as you said. Like you said, we saw it with Tatum, saw it with Lillard, saw it with Haliburton. Before the season, Daron Holmes had happened for him in the summer league with the Nuggets. It happened with Thanasis Antetokounmpo during his offseason workouts. Happened during the season with DeJounte Murray. Happened with Drew Smith, a two-way player. It happened just 2 days ago during pre-draft training with Jaylon Moore, a potential second-round pick out of Oklahoma. So it's happening in workouts that happen all the time, and it's happening more often in games. And for what it's worth, this a total amount, the eight for the players under contract, that exceeds the all-time amount of five that happened in the 24-15 season. That's the year Kobe tore his Achilles. And so I think for the NBA, what could be behind it is simply the sheer fact that players are running more miles over the course of the season, playing faster, paces up, putting more literal miles on their legs while playing a more athletically demanding game, having to close out side to side in the court, in the corners, above the break, running full sprint up and down the floor. And if you want to say maybe it's happening more to the Pacers, it might be related to the fact that they do that to the greatest extremes, the pace that they play with. So I think for Indiana, it's just unfortunate bad luck with the three of them. But at the same time, the way they play is reflective of why we could be seeing an uptick in these types of injuries. And so for the NBA, I don't know if they'll look at rule changes, removing the corner three, the length of the season. I don't think they're gonna do that anytime soon. But ultimately, I do think these injuries are a reality of the style of play and of the length of the season, where this is just gonna be a thing. With these players that are playing 70 plus games during the season, then have to play for 3 months in the postseason, I don't see it ending anytime soon with rule changes that aren't probably coming anytime soon, Tom. I'm just not expecting it. Are you?
You know, I was kind of shrugging off the idea of a 40-minute game, right? We talked about this after game six. Yeah. And I'm wondering if this is some sort of compromise where they just like, look, you guys don't want to lose games because that's a lot of revenues that you're going to lose, right? The players don't want to lose those revenues.
Unless the quality of games goes up and therefore revenue could go up. It's just a major risk.
I'm with you.
It's a risk for the league to actually do that.
I'm totally with you. I think that there is a lot of unseen potential for raising the stakes in regular season games. If there's, say, 50 or 60 regular season games, every game matters so much more. And I do think that TV partners,
every team advertisers, twice, that type of thing, right? So if you once you expand to 32 games, play everybody twice, 62 regular season games, plus whatever in-season games, play-in games, and then the playoffs. Like, to me, the quality is significantly higher, and there's ways you can gamify that as well.
Right. And I think that the stakes, the games would matter. And what we want is these games to feel like event programming, right? The NFL has this, college football has this, where every game you have to watch because it matters. Like if there's only two games between the Lakers and the Celtics, or that's a bad example because they're in two different conferences. If there's two games between OKC and Denver, or Kevin Durant's new team, the Houston Rockets, and his old team, the Phoenix Suns, if there's only two games on the calendar, each one is going to be so much more important to watch, right? So I think that the NBA is smart enough to know that they can't have Damian Lillard go down with an Achilles. They can't have Jason Tatum go down with an Achilles and Tyrese Haliburton go down with an Achilles. We've seen this isn't going to count because he's not technically missing a game, but I'm going to count it anyway. Six All-Stars in Tyrese Haliburton hurting his Achilles, six All-Stars missing games in the postseason. This is something that in previous eras, Kevin, we would see zero players, All-Stars, missing games in the postseason due to injury. Now we're seeing five, six, seven, eight every season. So this is, and I wrote about this a couple weeks ago when Jason Tatum went down for Yahoo Sports. I found that playoff injuries to star players are up sevenfold since the late 90s. sevenfold. So we're talking something that isn't just a blip, that it's not a one season blip. I just talked about the 2019 NBA Finals being marred by injuries on the Golden State Warriors. And yes, the Warriors were down 3-1 in the series when KD got hurt, and then up they were down 3-2 when Klay Thompson was hurt with his ACL. But we've seen this time and time again where the road to becoming a champion or the road to becoming a conference champion is a little bit lessened because of injuries on the other side. And it's becoming more of a fact. And I do think that if this continues happening, you're going to start to lose viewers tuning in because they don't have the star power that they once do. So I think it might hurt in the short term to cut games, but I think a long-term game in making these games matter and have fewer opportunities for injury.
I think that's spot on, Tom. I mean, ultimately, it could hurt in the short term. But if this is the way the game's going to go with spacing, three-point shooting, and fast pace, and I think the league likes that. I think the league likes the style of play because it's fun. It leads to comebacks. The Pacers don't come back without the style of play that they have throughout the postseason and the ways that they did with these historic comebacks. The league likes the style. If you like the style and if you're not going to make rule changes to increase the amount of mid-range jumpers, removing the corner three, all this type, these types of ideas you can throw up there, it has to be schedule related. And ultimately, though, the league has the rules that they have now. This is the way the season went. There were some key injuries. Halliburton goes down in this game. And I think some of the talk that was out there on social media today about, well, maybe you shouldn't let guys play who have calf injuries. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Halliburton would play this game over and over every time, every single time, even if he knew he was going to tear his Achilles with the chance to win a championship. Taking that away simply because you have a calf injury is worse than knowing you had a chance to win a championship. I just think it's absurd to even suggest calves should be treated like concussions are in the NFL. It's not the way to go about it. To me, it has to be any schedule-related changes to hopefully lessen the wear and tear. But you have to give these players agency and choice. Halliburton was off to an amazing start in the game. If he steps differently in that particular moment, he might get through the whole game. It just didn't hold up in that moment, and it's unfortunate that it didn't. But to me, Halliburton has the heart of a champion for going out there the way he did in Game 6 and then in Game 7, performing at the level he did, inspiring his team. And the Pacers had a shot, man. They had a shot. Like, they made a run in the second half. They had an 11-1 run in the fourth quarter. It got a little scary for OKC. Halliburton at one, SGA at one point has 5 fouls, no timeouts left for OKC. Like, you're thinking, like, oh, wait a minute here. It's not quite over.
Yeah. And
ultimately, man.
That's the legacy of the Pacers, dude. That's the legacy of the Pacers, is that comebacks. They could be down 15 with 5 minutes left, and you're like, uh-oh.
Like without their star, without their star too.
That's exactly right, dude. Like, how crazy is that? That you, this is the true lesson. The thing that we will always remember about these Pacers is that you could never count them out. That you could be watching an NBA Finals at OKC without Tyrese Halliburton at the on the floor. The game gets down to 10-point lead with like 2 minutes left, and you're like, the Pacers are going to pull this off. That is the legacy of these Pacers, that you can believe.
I was thinking, is this the NBA's 28-3 moment? Is what I was thinking about in my head. It's like, whoa. Tell me this, Tom. Do the Pacers win this game if Halliburton never gets hurt?
Oh, they have a great chance. I mean, you said it's 16-16 when he went down. It was a tie game. But if that OKC defense shows up in the second half, just like they did, I mean, it's tough. I think they have a great shot at winning this game, but because it was in OKC, I still give the edge to, in the long run of the full entire game, that I think OKC still pulls it out. But Tyrese Halliburton settles that offense and moves the ball so well. And I thought, you know, the TJ McConnell thing was so interesting to me, is that he got hot, but also their offense kind of went in hero mode. Siakam was off the floor and they just gave it to TJ McConnell, was like, go cook, go get these buckets. But that's not really how the Pacers work. And I think that this is kind of like the blessing and the curse of TJ McConnell, is that in those moments, if he gets caught on fire and he's just laying it up and getting to the rack every single time. That's awesome. But I also think that they kind of fell in love and got a little bit drunk on those things. Is that like what got them there to this point is moving the ball and getting really good shot opportunities for all five guys on the floor. And there was a point where TJ McConnell had 10 points to OKC's 10 points that he scored 12 straight points in that third quarter for the Pacers. And it was just like, I can't believe he's doing this, but he got gassed. I think ultimately the Pacers kind of lost their way a little bit offensively. They scored I'm going to pull it up here. 20 points in the third quarter, 23 in the fourth quarter. Things got kind of not garbage time, but kind of sideways there at the end of the fourth. Their offense, I don't think, was as crisp without Tyrese Haliburton. And he is kind of that stabilizer, that point one. You know, you hold the ball for 0.1 seconds before you move it. I really want to see the passing numbers after Tyrese Haliburton left the game, because I kind of felt like they lost themselves a little bit after that.
I totally agree with you, Tom. And I think with McConnell, he had 7 turnovers in the game. He made a bunch of sloppy mistakes, and you can't blame him necessarily. No. I mean, they need offense from somewhere. Like without Tyrese Haliburton, like Nembhard and Siakam. I thought Siakam at times was a bit too passive, but also more than anything else, I felt like Indiana again in this series. I felt this way earlier in the series as well. Just went away from him too often. I mean, he was on the bench for 6 minutes. In the middle of that third quarter. I mean, come on, it's a game 7 of the finals. What are we doing here? Is he on a minutes restriction in game 7, or is Carlisle forgetting what he has in Siakam? And I mean, ultimately, I think Indiana would have lost the game anyway. It probably would have been a little bit closer, a little bit more down to the wire, but I'm just a believer in that OKC defense. I mean, Dort had an unbelievable performance. I know everybody's going to get mad at him for the flop he had. When, I mean, he barely got touched in a flop, but he had a great play during that Pacers comeback a little bit in the fourth quarter. Pacers are down 12, 3 minutes left, and Pacers are on a fast break. Dort just sprints up the floor, strips the ball. He made a bunch of big plays. He had that moon ball three-pointer basically from the logo, the steals, the offensive boards. It was just a classic Lou Dort game. J-Dub was great defensively as well. Chet, 5 blocks in the game. As much work as he has to do offensively to continue getting better, he was just, I thought, excellent in the entire game defensively. Completely outplayed. Miles Turner was one of the best enforcers on the defensive end for OKC. And then Caruso off the bench as well, man. He hit those 2 big threes in the third quarter, I think it was. Had a big play defensively. Just up and down the board. Kayson Wallace had probably his best game of the whole series, I felt, overall. OKC's defense is just so deep. And you look at this team right now, they're the youngest champion since the 1977 Blazers, the Bill Walton Blazers. And this team just wins a championship with SGA, 27 years old next season, J-Dub 24, Chet Holmgren 23. This week they pick 15, 24, and 44 in the draft. Every player is under contract for next season. Next year they have up to 4 first-round draft picks. The Sixers first if it falls between 5 and 30, the Jazz first if it's between 9 and 30, and then the 2 most favorable first out of their own, the Rockets and the Clippers. So they got a young roster, still the most draft assets in the entire league. And they just won 68 games and won the NBA Finals. If there's any team set up for sustained success after we've seen 7 straight different champions, no back-to-backs, no repeats, it's the Thunder. This really could be the start of something here. No guarantees, but this team is set up, Tom, for a long, long, long sustained run of success. And they could only get better from here, from what we saw this year with them winning the championship.
Chet Holmgren missed 50 games this season and they won 68 games. You know, like they're not even fully powered. Like they're not. Like this year, they could have won 70 plus games. They could have broken the record, the regular season record, if they had their guys healthy. But of course, Chet Holmgren missed half the season and Isaiah Hartenstein missed half the season. So like, if you think this is the best it's going to be, I got news for you, Jack. It ain't. It ain't. I know Wemby's coming. He might be coming next year. And the Spurs are loading up. The Houston Rockets, and we'll probably talk about that later, they're loading up with Kevin Durant. But OKC also on top of that amazing cupboard of assets and just talent on the roster, Kev, they also have Nikola Topic, who a guy who was considered by many the best, most talented player in last year's draft at certain points of the year last year, and he's recovering from his ACL injury and is going to be on the roster next season. So, like, talk about ways to upgrade your team. They could either keep Topic and have him on the team, or trade him, flip him to a team that wants to rebuild and have kind of a cornerstone prospect. They have so many ways to upgrade what they already have. And yes, the Jalen Williams extension and the Chet Holmgren extension will come due at some point, but Sam Presti, time and time again, has figured out ways to improve the roster and think 3 years down the line. And 2012 was a long time ago. Like, I remember watching arm in arm James Harden, Russell Westbrook, and KD. As young as this core is right now with the Thunder, they were even better, I think, at the collective trio that they had there. And they got broken up soon after that, but I still think about that, and I got to believe that the front office in OKC still thinks about that. How can we ensure that this core and this group can stay together as long as possible within the confines of the CBA? They are absolutely a dynasty in the making in ways that I didn't think Boston was, and I don't think Denver was, because of how young this team is and how good this team is at this age.
With a minute 26 left in the fourth quarter, OKC is starting to sub out the starters, and the fans are going crazy and all that, and the ESPN flips to Sam Presti, and he's looking down at his phone texting. Do you think he was texting loved ones or negotiating a trade? 1:26 left in the game.
I think he's negotiating a trade. I think he's taking offers for his team.
I would be willing to bet it's something business related.
I think he's on the phone. Wait, so it's Topic, the 15 and the 24. Yeah, he's trying to figure out the next deal.
What do we need to do to move up to 6 or 7?
Wouldn't that be great? 1:26 left. Wouldn't that be great? Whoever caught Stephen A. Smith playing solitaire, we need to put them above Sam Presti in the 1:26. We need to figure out a way to get that
camera. Presti must have a screen protector on. He has to.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And look, dude, I keep coming back to this, the fact that they are, like you said, the youngest NBA champion in 50 years. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, he was every bit the finals MVP that we wanted him to be in this series. He had a couple of stretches where he was not his dominant self, certainly not his most efficient player performance here in Game 7. But guess what? Every Game 7 in the NBA Finals is played in the mud. The offensive rating in an NBA Finals is 100. Usually we see in the playoffs, it's a 105, 106, 107 offensive rating. That's points per 100 possessions. But in the NBA Finals, Game 7, with everything on the line, it just gets ugly out there. It is a dogfight. And in this game, there were stretches where it looked like both teams just could not get open looks, exhausted. Everybody knows their plays. Everybody knows their tendencies. And it looks like both teams were just playing in the mud. And that's what happens. Like you said, if you go back in game sevens or even in clinching scenarios, there's a lot of ugly shooting lines for guys that we remember.
Kobe game seven versus Boston in 2010 was 6 of 24.
Yeah. Yeah.
6 of 24. But the game was 83-79. Inefficient for everybody. He gave the game what it needed and got to the free throw line and rebounded like crazy, played defense like crazy. It's not just about efficiency in these games. Like, I think you're right there, Tom, because for SGA, he gave it what he needed. And by the way, it was his first finals against a great Pacers defense. They were awesome defensively, extending to a game seven, a game six, changing their scheme with the pickup point, among other things. They were great. Playing a factor in why SGA wasn't super efficient. But sorry, I'm interjecting there with what you're saying about SGA.
Well, here's a stat for you that blew my mind. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander in this series averaged 30.3 points per game, right? 5+ rebounds per game, about 5 assists per game. No other player had more blocks in this finals than Shai Gilgeous-Alexander.
Wow.
He was the team leader with 11 blocks tied with Chet Holmgren with 11 blocks. Chet Holmgren had 5 blocks in this game to give himself 11 for this series. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander was leading Chet Holmgren and Isaiah Hartenstein in this series in shots blocked. And now, as you see it here on the screen, 30.3 points, 5.6 assists, 1.9 steals per game. He had another two tonight, and then 1.6 blocks per game. That is insane. Like, no other player had as many blocks in this series, more blocks than Shai Gilgeous-Alexander in this series. That's your point guard for the Oklahoma City Thunder, is leading the team along with Chet Holmgren in blocks with 11 for the series. So when we talk about great steals,
Tom, with his length too, like the way he got the steals, it isn't just like deflection, he gets the ball. It was like Siakam posting up down low and SGA reaching around and using his long wingspan to get the ball away from Siakam on the low post and earlier in that series. Like, some amazing steals he had.
Yeah, and this is also why he's so good at drawing fouls, is because he's got great proprioception. That's how you see things around you, sense the movements around you, and you slow the game down. Yeah. Stephen Curry, Kawhi Leonard.
Thank you for explaining that word. I appreciate it.
I learned it from P3.
I would have went with awareness. That's the word I'd use.
Well, awareness. Done. Thank you for translating it for me. It is awareness, that quarter weight is.
I don't know, master's degree or something in English? I don't know.
I listen to too many of these sports science like podcasts where they just talk about the processing speed of these guys, like Steph Curry and his dribbling and how he can kind of like sense peripheral vision, like all of it. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is the same way. His processing power is up there with the very best. If you are slightly off balance, he's going to make you pay for it. The rules say that you cannot extend your arm fully on a push off, and he knows this. So when he puts his shoulder into you, he's going to make sure that that hand is not going to extend all the way. That is a lot of awareness, the proprioception that I'm talking about. This is a guy who understands his body and also all the bodies around him in ways that it feels like he's got this like super chip in his brain. And that is something that Steph Curry has, that LeBron has, that the greats have. And he absolutely has it. Scoring title, MVP, NBA Finals, only 3 other players: Kareem, Shaq, and Michael Jordan. Great stat there. This dude, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, a guy that I thought was the MVP coming into this season. I said OKC was going to win it all this season. From the start of the season, I said this. And he made me look smart. He made me look smart. But do not look at that round table I did today. Don't look at it, Kev, when I said that the Pacers were going to win Game 7. Don't. Scrub it from the history. I said Pacers are going to win this one, and so I'm hoping that no one is watching this on YouTube. I hope no one is actually watching.
Wow!
I said Pacers are going to win Game 7. Yeah.
Oh my god!
What,
Tom?
What? I mean, it was 16-16 when Tyrese got hurt.
I felt bad not participating in that round table, but I'm just buried in draft stuff. I got a mock draft coming out. I got multiple draft articles coming out this week. Did an emergency podcast on the Kevin Durant trade with John Gambadoro. And then we had a recording with J. Kyle Mann on the draft. That podcast is out already if you want some deep dives into the KD stuff and with some draft talk. And Tom, we'll talk about KD in a minute. But before we do that, I do want to talk about the Pacers with what's next for them, because during the finals, they made a trade and they dealt the number 23 pick this year. And they got their 2026 first next season. Boy, what perfect timing to get your own first in 2026 with Tyrese Haliburton being out for probably all of next season. You tore your Achilles in all likelihood in the middle of June. 9-month minimum recovery. Like, you're talking April already. In all likelihood, he's out for all of next season. And so to get your own pick back in 2026 is a grand slam for them. But I am curious, Tom, for this Pacers team, no Haliburton for next season. They enter an offseason with a lot of uncertainty. What are some silver linings here for the Pacers? Like, what is there to look forward to next season without the hopes of getting back to the championship in all likelihood next year? Tell me something to feel good about if I'm a Pacers fan.
35 minutes a game for Andrew Nembhard. Like, that guy
blossoms as a star, possibly.
Yep. Exactly. Exactly. Is we've been kind of seeing it. He is a playoff riser in ways that few players can do this. But Andrew Nembhard raises his play in the playoffs like a star player. Right. And I think with the Tyrese Haliburton, if there's a silver lining here, it's that he can go out there and try to get not just minutes, 35 minutes and starter minutes. I'm talking like getting votes for All-Star. We've seen it in history before where guys step up in a place of injury where they step up and you're like, wait a minute, this guy might actually be better than our starter. I'm not saying that for Tyrese Haliburton, but when you're talking about Andrew Nembhard and how good he's been, two-way player in this postseason, you can see that this dude has another level that he can get to. And you got TJ McConnell, like of all the teams in the NBA that can kind of shoulder this burden of Tyrese Haliburton being out for a full season potentially, they are very well constructed to do this because of those two guys, Andrew Nembhard and TJ McConnell. And don't forget about Benedict Mathurin, who's going to have to pick up a lot of the scoring load that Tyrese Haliburton was one of their top creators this season. I think this team is actually pretty well equipped to withstand this injury. I'm not saying they're going to be better, but you're going to have another pick next season to try to fill like a point guard of the future alongside Tyrese Haliburton. And this is a really good opportunity for them. Is there anyone that now you're thinking about it now after this injury? Of course, you're going to be doing a mock draft. Is there anyone in this draft that you're looking like, hey, now that this injury, we have new information with the Pacers going forward. Is there anyone you're thinking more about that could be a good fit for the Pacers?
No, not this year. not this year after trading number 23. I mean, I think for them, you know, if you trade back into the second round and you get a top 45 or so pick, you know, you have 54 right now. Go get Andrew Nembhard's brother, Ryan Nembhard. That would be interesting to me. I don't think he's going to make it to 54 where Indiana has their only choice right now. But if they were to move up and get 40 to 45, that range, you get a shot to get Ryan Nembhard and play with the Nembhard bros all year. I think that'd be really cool. But other than that, I don't think there's anybody in the second round that I'd be, you know, jumping for joy about if I'm the Pacers. But Nembhard can help you really run that offense over the course of the season and be a McConnell replacement at some point in the future too, with McConnell being as old as he is.
You know what's interesting about that? I did a study once that looked at brothers on the same team, and they absolutely get better when they're on the same team. Like the Morris twins, the Wagner brothers. Like Franz Wagner took off once Mo Wagner came over onto the team. Like that's not a coincidence. When Marcus Morris and Markieff Morris played together in Phoenix, similar things happen. We see Giannis Antetokounmpo and how much it mattered to him to have Thanasis on the team, both on the court, off the court. This is a real thing in the NBA, is that when you are out there with your sibling, your ability to score, your ability to play great basketball is heightened because of that. And I think we need more of a sample size, but there has been research to show that brothers on the same team, they do improve your play. And so that wouldn't be a bad idea, is to get Nembhard, his brother, to come play for the Indiana Pacers, because I think there is something there. And especially with a gap year where you might be, you know, down in the 40s win total, Pascal Siakam's too good for them to kind of bottom out next season without Tyrese Haliburton. The roster's too good. Like the East is not good enough, and the roster's too good for them to tank or to bottom out next season. But it will be, I suspect, a better pick than 23 this year.
Yeah, I think so too. The deal works out big time for them. And like, we'll see what they do with Miles Turner, who's a free agent this offseason. His status could depend on what minutes are going to look like at the center position. But Jairus Walker, I hope he gets more opportunities, more touches, more minutes next season. I've been impressed with what he's shown early on in his career. So I hope he gets some chances as well. And even a guy like Ben Shepherd, you know, maybe he gets bigger minutes. But ultimately, though, the biggest silver lining, as you said, is Andrew Nembhard being the guy and getting an opportunity all over the course of next season. And like you said, the East, it's awful. I mean, like it's even worse now. At one point, it's the Celtics and the Bucks and the Pacers and the Knicks and the Cavs. And now the Celtics are without Tatum for most, if not all, of next season. Bucks without Damian Lillard. Pacers without Haliburton. The Eastern Conference odds are the Knicks, in the Cavs, and then probably the Magic after that. there's not a lot of clarity after the Knicks and Cavaliers. I think the Magic are third on all the draft books, all the sports books. My brain is on the draft right now, all the sports books. Look, I do think this, Tom, all of this stuff that's happened, all these injuries, would further increase my desire to stay in the East if I'm Giannis Antetokounmpo, to stay with the Bucks and say, you know what? Why can't we be a top four seed in the Eastern Conference with me and a slightly better supporting cast around me? If I'm Giannis, I think my likelihood of staying in Milwaukee has dramatically increased despite the Rockets getting Kevin Durant, despite the appeal and going there or somewhere else. I think, why not? Why not?
Is there a trade in the East that would make sense? Like if Evan Mobley was on the table, I'm not saying he would be on the table, but if Cleveland was like,
yeah. On that note, Tom, Gambadoro did say to me on the podcast earlier that the Cleveland Cavaliers were one of the sleeper teams for Kevin Durant. That at least shows they have a willingness to take big swings. I heard that they offered Garland in that deal for Kevin Durant. Garland is not Evan Mobley. But to your point, if they were to think about something like that, they're at least, when exploring a KD deal, they've at least shown a willingness to think big and go for a big star player. So maybe they would. Maybe they would. That's all I'm adding to that.
Yeah, I mean, because if you're Giannis and you're saying, what is my best chance of winning a championship? Are you looking at Detroit? Are you looking at the Cleveland Cavaliers? Are you looking at another situation that would give you a chance to stay in the East but upgrade your supporting cast? And this is the tough thing about the NBA, the trade market in this year, this new CBA. There's no free agency anymore. So if you're going to go pick a team, you're going to gut that team that you're going to. And it becomes a lot trickier than, say, when LeBron was a free agent, was like, I'm going to the Miami Heat. Or when KD was a free agent, was like, I'm going to the Brooklyn Nets, or I'm going to the Golden State Warriors. It's so tough for a guy like Giannis, like, because if you're going to go to Cleveland, or if you're going to go to Detroit, or if you're going to go to Orlando, I'm just throwing out these teams that are up and coming that could put in assets to get a guy like Giannis, you're going to kind of cannibalize your chances of winning the East. So you might be right that Giannis's best chance is going to be in the Eastern Conference, and it might be with the Milwaukee Bucks. But I'm not willing to say that Giannis is going to be 100% in Milwaukee this offseason, especially with all the movement that we're going to see. Is the calculus is going to change. Like, is Devin Booker going to be happy with the way that things have gone with Jalen? Who was it? I think it was Dan Feldman who had a great tweet where he did the depth chart for the Phoenix Suns, and it was just eight players at shooting guard. And it was just so funny. It was just Grayson Allen, Bradley Beal, Jalen Green, Devin Booker. Like, there's just all shooting guards. And I'm like, yeah, how is that Jalen Green fit going to be with Devin Booker? I'm not saying Devin Booker is going to be demanding a trade, but I can see a scenario in which halfway through the season, this Phoenix Suns are 10 games at under 500. And he's like, I'm not doing this again. We got to figure something out.
Look, I think with Booker, he should think about it. I don't know why he wouldn't think about it, because this team isn't going to win anytime soon. And you're in your late 20s at this point. You've been to one finals. You lost. It's just, who is that team in the East? I mean, the Knicks already blew their picks last summer. They're not that team. The Wizards aren't ready. The Hornets are interesting because LaMelo, Brandon Miller, Bridges, they have some talent there, but I don't think
LaMelo's... Bridges, where did he go to college again?
Michigan State, of course. Michigan State, of course. Okay. So the Hornets are interesting if they were to get one guy and then go get another guy. The Sixers are very intriguing because of the draft capital they have, including the number three pick. But they don't have the movable salaries. Paul George is very difficult to move, but they're interesting. The Nets have a ton of cap space, but they're a clean slate. They have nothing like on the roster. Nick Claxton, Cam Johnson, and that's it. They're a clean slate regardless of, other than that. The Raptors, I don't think they're a serious team with getting some of these star players yet. I don't know, like the Heat, maybe like somebody like that. But are you going to demand a trade out of Phoenix if you're Booker for the Miami Heat? You know what I mean? Like, I don't necessarily see it with some of these teams that could get him. I don't think it's a clear cut destination for him, in my opinion, if you're Devin Booker. That's just my gut feeling here, Tom. I think it would be a surprising thing if a team were to make an offer to Phoenix as well, because they didn't get their picks back in the trade for Kevin Durant. They got the 10th pick this year, but they didn't get their 27. They didn't get their 29. And that ultimately is a bummer for them. But they don't want their own picks back. They want to be competitive. That's what I've been reporting on all year. They don't want their own picks back because they want to be competitive. They don't want to be a team that's relying on their own picks.
How's that working out for them?
It's not working out for them. It's not. But that's what they want. So that if that's what they want, I don't think they'd be a team that's willingly trading Booker. It would have to be Booker forcing his way out. And at this particular moment, I don't see the team that makes perfect sense for him that also has draft capital. But maybe that team will pop up at some point in the future. But I don't think it's there at this particular moment.
I mean, it's just weird how they keep boxing themselves in and with these, like, teams can read them like a book, you know, like they could, if you're not interested in replenishing your draft picks, I just feel like that's less leverage in talks, you know, like if people already know what your plan is, then it just seems like you're shooting yourself in the foot. I mean, the Phoenix Suns, let's just rewind here. The Matt Ishbia reign has been a disaster. Okay. They've spent $250 million in luxury tax payments, just luxury tax payments in the last three seasons. I calculated this. $272 million that the Phoenix Suns have paid over the last three seasons in just luxury tax payments. $152 million this past season, $68 million the season before that, and $52 million the year before that. $270 million just in luxury tax fees. They're subsidizing the rest of the NBA for one playoff win, one series. They've won one series in the last three seasons, six total games in the postseason with Kevin Durant in the Kevin Durant era. That's what they got. $250 million in luxury tax fees and one playoff series. They're 13th in playoff wins in the Matt Ishbia reign. Like 2023, 2024, and 2025, the last 3 years, they're 6-9 in the playoffs, 13th most wins across the NBA, and they're tied for eighth in playoff victories over that span. $250 million in luxury tax payments. They traded Chris Paul for Bradley Beal and his no trade clause, along with four pick swaps. Think about that. They gave up Chris Paul. Oh, DeAndre Ayton. We traded DeAndre Ayton for Tamani Kamara and Yusuf Nurkic. We sent away Tamani Kamara and DeAndre Ayton to get Yusuf Nurkic. And, oh, by the way, like Kevin Durant, we're going to trade Mikal Bridges, Cam Johnson, and Jay Crowder over to the Brooklyn Nets. Four first-round picks and a swap. And when we trade Kevin Durant away to Houston, we're only going to get one first-round pick out of the deal. So we went through three head coaches. Three head coaches over that span. Kev, I don't see how you go from like what they were at, you know, 2021 with the NBA finals and having 60 win seasons, and then to what they are now. It's been a disaster, man. An absolute, we got to call it what it is.
God, I know. It has been an absolute disaster, and there's no signs it's necessarily going to get better. It really all starts from now for Brian Gregory and Matt Ishbia, whoever's making the calling all the shots here. It's clearly Ishbia Gregory, some type of collaboration there. James Jones, he's faded away. He doesn't have much of a voice there anymore at this point. So for the Phoenix Suns, you traded KD. Say what you want about the return. This is what you got. You're hoping Jalen Green can pop with his second team in his NBA career and not let this be the start of him becoming a journeyman who bounces team to team, which he could be. There is that path for him if he doesn't work out in Phoenix. You get the 10th pick. What are you going to do with that? What are you going to do with Bradley Beal? Gambo said to me on part one of this podcast that he believes Bradley Beal will either be traded, which would mean, of course, Beal needs to waive his no trade clause, or he gets bought out. And if he gets bought out, that means part of his salary, whatever is agreed to with his camp, with his agent, would still be on your books. But either way, Gambo says a 0% chance that Bradley Beal is on the Phoenix Suns next year, which would open up some minutes for shooting guards, some two guards on that roster, Tom. So for the Suns, they get a lot to clean up. Listen to part one with Gambo for a lot more on the Suns side of things. For the overall NBA league-wide side of things here, Tom, I'm curious, what do you make of the Cavaliers being one of those sleeper teams for Kevin Durant, offering Darius Garland? Clearly they didn't land him. He's going to Houston, KD is. But for Cleveland, it does give an insight into their thinking here, looking to flip Darius Garland after a dominant regular season and a major disappointment in the playoffs. They're definitely swinging for something. So what could be next for them, and what do you make of them offering Garland in a deal for Durant?
Well, again, I don't want to read too much into this NBA Finals, but can you see Donovan Mitchell and Darius Garland healthy, both of them being able to stay onto the floor, like two-way players? You need guys who can do it both ends of the floor. And those two are some of the two most extreme offensively inclined players in the NBA. They're great offensively. Great. But they're undersized for their position, and they can't defend on the other side of the floor. So they feel like, to me, two guys where you can't have them if you want to win in the biggest moments. You can't have two of them. You can have one of them, but you can't have two. And so I think what you're going to see is a lot of these kind of rumors going forward with the Cleveland Cavaliers to try to move Darius Garland. And his toe injury is going to be a problem, because unlike bigs, if you don't have wheels as an undersized point guard, it's going to be really tough for you to exist in the NBA at a high level. You saw Isaiah Thomas when he had his torn labrum in his hip and he wasn't able to move as well. It's really difficult for you to maintain your all-star, all-NBA caliber play if you just can't get around the floor and be as nimble as he was pre-injury. Same thing for Darius Garland, is the fact that when you're dealing with his contract, his injury, and the long layoff, it's going to be tough to move him right now. But I do think you're going to need more guys like Andrew Nembhard on your team, like Aaron Nesmith on your team, guys that can defend at a high level and not be so offensively skewed. And I think that's what the Cleveland Cavaliers have to figure out is going forward. Maybe you talk to the Houston Rockets and try to get Tari Eason, or maybe you try to talk to OKC and you say, hey, look, you're going to have to pay these guys eventually. Why don't you have a glut of great defenders on the wing? Alex Caruso, Kayson Wallace, and Lou Dort. Can we get one of those dudes on our team? The question is, I don't see how OKC looks at this roster and says, yeah, we want Darius Garland on our team. Like, I don't think that really makes too much sense. Maybe in a three-team deal where the guy is trying to add a star player or a point guard to try to free up some scoring at the point guard position. But like, if you're Cleveland, I don't know how you watch this NBA Finals or even the conference finals and say, we can get away with two of these guys.
Their own series as well. Their own series. I mean, I've referenced the quote 100 times in the podcast, it feels like, at this point, but Kenny Atkinson, within a minute, basically unprompted on the podium after they got eliminated, was talking about the force and the speed and the physicality of the Pacers compared to his team, where he's like, we're lacking that. And it's partially a physical thing, but it's also a mental thing. And I think Atkinson and that front office led by Kobe Altman, they're looking for some big changes because they're trying to capitalize on what they have, and they know they can't just run it back with this core. They know they have to make tweaks, and they're going to go for it. And the Heat, some of these other teams, the Heat, like these preferences for Kevin Durant, Miami wasn't making a significant offer. They're probably waiting for somebody younger, and they're cheap anyway. They cheaped out on Damian Lillard with their offer. They cheaped out for Kevin Durant. It's on brand with the Heat. The Spurs are interesting because they had some incentive to go for Kevin Durant, but they have some other stuff they're thinking about as well, too. I think they want to go for a bigger fish at some point, as Sham said a couple weeks ago on Pat McAfee. But also, they're still in an interesting spot with that number two pick. I've heard from a number of sources over the weekend, Tom, that the Spurs are listening to offers for that number two pick. Listening. They're not expected to deal the number two pick, but one GM said to me, the Spurs are asking for a ridiculous haul to get the number two pick from one of those teams behind them drafting between 3 and 5 or 6 or so. So at a minimum, the Spurs are listening for number two. It's just something to keep in mind when it comes to the draft on Thursday, on Wednesday and Thursday. On Wednesday, of course, we'll see Cooper Flagg go one to the Dallas Mavericks. Spurs mostly expected to take Dylan Harper with the number two pick, but they're listening for that pick. And so just something to keep in mind with what their priorities are.
Yeah. You know, one thing I was just thinking about is like, do the Spurs need to upgrade at that position in the same way that the Cavaliers do? Is just a guy that you can know that is going to defend the opposing guy, like a Davion Mitchell, a Asar Thompson, an Amen Thompson. I'm trying to think of like other guys that the San Antonio Spurs could use at that position to really upgrade their point of attack defense. And in the backcourt, De'Aaron Fox isn't that guy. I don't think that Stephon Castle is there yet. Maybe he can get there, but like to that point of Darius Garland, like how many guys do you think fits the mold of what the Cavs need and would be willing to take on Darius Garland? Like, would the Magic be open to trading Jalen Suggs for Darius Garland?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either. It sounds crazy, right? It sounds crazy given that he had an injured season.
And that's why, like, when you talk about Garland, small guard, limited defender, and then you talk about the Spurs with the number two pick, the pick is essentially Dylan Harper. 6'5", long arms, big, strong, burly frame, gets downhill, gets into the paint, can be switchable defensively. You hope he figures out the jumper. Harper is the type of guy you project as somebody who can play and excel in the playoffs because of his size, because of his ability to cut and move off ball. He's projects as a playoff point guard. And that's why the Spurs would be incentivized to keep him and just figure it out with Fox, Castle, and Harper, three guards that don't really shoot well from three and don't open up space at the rim for Victor Wembanyama because of Harper's talent, but also why they're asking for a massive haul if they were to move down from this pick, and also why the teams behind them might be incentivized to actually give it come Wednesday night. If you think about the Sixers, the balance in that backcourt next to Maxey, what Harper and those two would have, Charlotte insurance behind LaMelo Ball, but also next to LaMelo Ball with Harper, two big point guards, long, lengthy point guards. Both of them can play with and without the ball. Utah needs a guard. Washington needs a true point guard. New Orleans, who knows what's going to happen with DeJounte Murray, especially after he was trashing the team in his interview. Brooklyn has nothing on their roster at number 8. Like every team, 3 through 8, really needs a Dylan Harper. Really needs a Dylan Harper. And with these playoffs we just watched, everybody knows Dylan Harper, assuming the shot at least becomes a competent level, is a playoff level point guard with his size and length and versatility and skill set. So the Spurs are right to ask for a lot. It's just going to be interesting, man, because I wouldn't be surprised if something shocking happened. I really wouldn't be, because of how good he is as a prospect. He would have been number one. He would have been number one, Tom, if Cooper Flagg never reclassified.
Can we call it in with the Yahoo Sports commissioner? Is Lauri Markkanen and the number 5?
Not enough. I think they'd want more than that. Ooh. They'd want more. They would want
the
even
Spurs
more than
would
that.
Want more than Markkanen.
Oh yeah, they'd
and
want
the
even
number
more.
5.
Yeah, they'd want even more. That's my impression. Wow. The GM I talked to, it'll be in the mock draft tomorrow. Some more details on this, but the GM said to me, "He's like, I don't think anybody's going to meet what they're asking for." But maybe,
man,
all it takes is a team to say, "Screw it, we want Dylan Harper." I always think back to the deal that never happened. Remember when Justice Winslow was falling in the 2014 draft? He was like maybe going to go 2 or 3 or 4, and then he's there in after 10, and Danny Ainge is calling everybody, offering 4 first-round picks, 5 first-round picks. Sometimes on the night of the draft, you get desperate, and when the Spurs are on the clock, or even after they select Dylan Harper, that value is not going down. If anything, the value of Dylan Harper could go up in summer league. That's always possible, and so the Spurs are going to take Dylan Harper unless they get a massive offer. And it's just an interesting thing, because I wrote about it in depth on Yahoo with like the issues with the fit with Fox and Castle and Harper. And I know Spurs fans who are all about Harper hate me for, no pun intended, harping on it this entire pre-draft phase. But look, man, I think it's a real possibility. Sources around the league thinks it's a real possibility. It's just unlikely, considering the level of talent that Harper has. And in all likelihood, the Spurs are going to just try to figure things out after they pick him on Wednesday night and go from there. But ultimately, the KD trade might have just been the start of a pretty crazy week, yes. Tom. Might have just been the start.
Hey, you know what I think? The first thing I thought of with the KD trade is free Reed Shepherd. We have freed Reed Shepherd.
That's the first thing.
First thing I thought of, KOC, was Reed Shepherd, most improved player of the year next year. Jalen Green is out of here.
Van Vliet. No, Van Vliet next. Get him out of there next.
Get him out of here.
Really open it all up for Reed Shepherd.
Reed Shepherd and KD, I can see it now. They're going to be in the Western Conference Finals with Amen Thompson, and they are going to go at OKC, and it's going to be great. We got Kentucky versus Kentucky, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, and Reed Shepherd. I love this trade because it gives us more opportunities to see if Reed Shepherd can fulfill his destiny as the next baby Steph. Like, I love Reed Shepherd, and this trade without Jalen Green out there and Dylan Brooks also at the guard position, I think it cracks about 10, 15 minutes a game for Reed Shepherd and maybe more, and I'd love to see it. What is Jalen Green? Is he like the seventh best player on the Houston Rockets? Like, the fact that they got Kevin Durant without giving up a future first round pick of the Phoenix Suns. Like, I know number 10 is theirs, but the fact that they were able to give up no first round picks, no Tari Eason, no Amen Thompson, no Alpi Shangun, even the Fred Van Vliet, if they pick up the player option, the team option, That's an expiring contract for the Phoenix Suns to try to replenish the books next year. But obviously they're not interested. They love paying $100 million in luxury tax payments, as we've learned. It just feels like the Phoenix Suns just gave away Kevin Durant for 50 cents on the dollar. And I guess I don't like Jalen Green as much as some people do. A guy who, outside of that 138-point game in that first round series against Golden State, averaged 9 points a game. He averaged 13 points a game in that series against Golden State. And I know he's young, but I don't love his game in the same way that I'm not in love with Ace Bailey too. It's just like guys who are bucket getters, like who are really good at creating their own shot, but are inefficient. I just feel like they're fading away in today's NBA. And I don't see it with Jalen Green. I think this is a really, really, really poor return for the Phoenix Suns. And you can point to the 5 second round picks, and Dylan Brooks is a guy that they can flip, or he's a guy that can defend. But so many guys I feel like would work in Phoenix, but they haven't. Yusuf Nurkic, Grayson Allen had one great year, and now he can't get off the bench. Ryan Dunn looked great for like 2 weeks this season and then just kind of fell off from there. I don't like this trade for the Phoenix Suns. It's not an F, but to me, it's in the D range. And I think the Houston Rockets did great to wait and get Kevin Durant now.
I saw some stuff on social media today about, hey, the two guards in the finals were traded early in their careers. SGA from the Clippers to the Thunder, and Halliburton from the Kings to the Pacers. And I'm like, yeah, but Halliburton and SGA made immense progress early in their careers. Jalen Green has not at all. He stayed pretty much the same physically as he did when he was a rookie, and game-wise, he is not notably better than he was entering his rookie season out of the G League. He still struggles with the same things. He has not improved on his consistency as a three-point shooter, despite being an 80-plus percent guy from the line as well. So he has touch. It just hasn't translated off the dribble with any consistency like it did for Halliburton, like it did for SGA early in their careers. And those guys both got stronger. They both became better ball handlers. Jalen Green hasn't. So unless it's going to happen for him now in year 5 and beyond at 23 plus years old, I was a Jalen Green guy. I believed in him. I've lost a lot of faith in him. And ultimately, I think the Rockets dealt him at the perfect time with that new contract coming up. It's just perfect timing for them to do this now. And so they get Kevin Durant, directly address a major, major flaw on the team, shot creation. KD's still one of the best three-point shooters and isolation scorers in all of basketball. Still a very good defensive player as well, so they don't lose a lot on defense either. And they still have so much versatility. They have two first-round picks in 27, their own first or the Nets' first, and the Suns' first in 27. They have their own first in 28. In 2029, they have the two most favorable of the Mavericks, the Suns, and their own. In 2030, 2031, and 2032, they have their own first. So that means the Rockets have up to five tradable first-round picks, their own in 28, 30, and 32, one in 27, and one in 29, and then they have the option to swap the other firsts as well. So you talk about their youth on the team that they still have. You talk about the picks they still have, the tradable contracts they still have. If the Rockets wanted to, they could go out there and try their best to go get another guy now or during the season. And so this team, I'm not ready to fully grade what their offseason, you know, additions have been with Kevin Durant, and it's an A so far, but it could easily become an A++++ with all of those assets and draft capital they still have to play with, and what is a really smart, driven front office to go in now. Don't be surprised if the Rockets are involved in more rumors this week and during free agency in July. Don't be surprised at all with all of those picks. They're not just going to sit on that.
Can I make a confession here? I just went on SpotTrack and started looking at Giannis trades with Houston. Like, we're still there. Like, we're still in the ballpark of, like, wait a minute. They kept all of those assets away from the Phoenix Suns trade to get Kevin Durant. They can now go out and get Giannis. Like, they can still do this.
Or try.
Like, San Antonio.
At least try.
They can try.
They can try.
They have.
Giannis would have to obviously ask for Houston, but also, from the Giannis side of things, maybe KD is the Ray Allen to Giannis's KG, right? Like, where Kevin Durant goes to Houston, like Ray Allen once went to Boston in 08 or 07, and then Kevin Garnett decided, okay, I do want to go to Boston. Giannis could therefore see the appeal in going to the Rockets now. So he'd have to do it first of all, but the Rockets do have the assets to make a really appealing offer to the Bucks. Jabari Smith, see ya. Reed Shepard, peace out. Like, it's very possible you put any of these types of guys on the table and say, hey, take your pick, Milwaukee. Take your pick. What do you want? Picks? Players? We got it all.
I mean, I just think they got another thing up their sleeve. And San Antonio still has a lot of assets to upgrade around Wemby. And we have that Wemby window where it's like his extension is going to come up here in a couple years, but he's getting paid like a mid-level guy over the next two seasons. So they have some cap space and assets to make another big move. The question is, who is that guy? And I wonder, do you feel like, Kev, did they make a mistake by trading for De'Aaron Fox? I mean, I guess hindsight is 20/20, but Dylan Harper doesn't feel like the best fit for that backcourt right now. But would you feel better about their prospects going forward if they had the number two pick and Stephon Castle without De'Aaron Fox?
I think they got Fox so cheap. I'd say no.
Yeah.
I still think it was worth it. It's not like they gave up a ton of valuable firsts. Fox did a good job of leveraging his way to the Spurs. And this brings up something that I think you'll like, Tom. The clutch connections in San Antonio are getting really, really strong, okay? They hired Sean Sweeney as their assistant coach today, represented by Clutch Sports. Mitch Johnson, their head coach, represented by Clutch Sports. Trade for De'Aaron Fox, represented by Clutch Sports. Their GM, Brian Wright, represented by Clutch Sports. So there's a strong connection there within the organization of Clutch growing, connected with star player, star point guard, coach, and assistant coach, and GM. So for the San Antonio Spurs, when you think about what they could prioritize in the draft or in trades or free agency, I think the clutch connection is just something to think about. with the Spurs point, Tom. It's very, I knew you loved
tingly,
this.
Man. I got all tingly. This is so good. This is so good. Yeah, CAA and the Knicks. Then you got Clutch in San Antonio. And you have
no longer the Lakers. They have detached from the Lakers, and now they are latched onto the Spurs.
You got Excel in Denver, where they had everybody on the roster was an Excel client of Jeff Schwartz, including Nikola Jokic and Russell Westbrook. We'll see what happens with Russell Westbrook. So you're saying that there's a Clutch connection brewing in San Antonio. Mm-hmm. Wemby is not in there. Wemby is not but as we know from Chris Paul, Clutch and Rich Paul, whoever is on that team is guaranteed to be at least a target to be coming part of the Clutch clientele. So man, I think that's really interesting.
I'd be surprised if Wemby ever left ComSport. Buna, the head of ComSport, was there with Wemby when Wemby was just a teenager. So I'd be surprised there. I'd be very surprised. But you never know.
Sure. I thought Anthony Davis with his agent would never give up his agent to go over to LA. But once he switched over to Rich Paul, that was a done deal that he went over to the Lakers. So I've seen some crazy things in the league, but this, I love this stuff. It's, I think, one of the most talked about things behind the scenes in the NBA is just the importance of agencies and the alliances that certain front offices and coaches have with certain agencies. And the public doesn't know about this stuff. And that's why I keep writing about it, is because when you start talking to people and the conversation always comes back to this thing, but it's not public information, I feel like there's a gap that needs to be closed, and that gap is being closed by you, KOC. And I salute you for getting people aware for these agency alliances that really matter. When Leon Rose was Karl Anthony Towns' agent and had the biggest salary on his payroll at CAA, and Tom Thibodeau and Worldwide West and Jalen Brunson, and the story with his father, Rick Brunson, was Leon Rose's first client. Like, this stuff does matter, and relationships matter in the NBA in ways that I don't think the public really understands. And so I think this is a really good point by you. And Sean Sweeney going to San Antonio, that is a big deal. And he's a guy that worked with Giannis Antetokounmpo, and I do think that there's, you know, not to say that Wemby and Giannis, it's going to be a done deal, but I think those relationships will be strengthened with San Antonio when you got a guy like Sean Sweeney, who has connections around the league and relationships, that is going to help them as they move on from Greg Popovich and start building out this coaching staff to make sure that it is modernized, that the relationships and the younger coaches around the league, that you build these relationships, that they can be strengthened, and that suddenly these trades, a trade demand, why a certain player has a certain team on that list of trade destinations, it might come down to, I trust this guy. I used to play for him. I want to play for him again. And that's why I think San Antonio, it's a great hire in Sean Sweeney. And I do think that the Dallas Mavericks, it's just a continued, just, I don't understand their offseason in so many ways. Like, how is Jason Kidd not having an extension?
Dudley could leave now too. Dudley could leave as well.
You got the opportunity to coach Cooper Flagg, and you're leaving to go to San Antonio, and Jason Kidd still hasn't signed his contract extension for that we know of. Something is afoot in Dallas.
I know. I agree, Tom. And speaking of relationships, Royal Ivy is an assistant coach for the Houston Rockets under Ime Udoka, and Ivy and KD have been like best friends or close friends for a very, very long time, since they were teammates earlier in their careers. And so that's part of the reasons why Houston had appeal, Ime Udoka relationship there, and the roster on top of it. Relationships are all a lot. Tom, I felt like you and I have built a great relationship this entire year, these podcasts every year. I can't believe the season's over. But it's not really over. The draft is on Wednesday and Thursday, and free agency's around the corner. The season is just beginning in some ways, but the games are over.
Congratulations to the Oklahoma City Thunder, the seventh champion in seven straight years. And I suspect that whole new NBA champion every year is coming to an end here, because OKC has a potential dynasty, a repeat. I would say they're heavy favorites to repeat next season. And again, they've got draft picks coming up. They've got Topic coming back, and they've got a lot of assets that they can upgrade this roster. This crazy. OKC team is a dynasty in the making, man.
I can't believe it. Tom, here we are. End of the season on Wednesday on Yahoo Sports. I'll be streaming live for 2 hours, 3 hours. I don't know how long it'll be. We'll be doing a live show on Wednesday, Tom, covering the NBA draft on Yahoo Sports, on YouTube, X, Facebook, TikTok. I'm looking forward to that. It's going to be a lot of fun. Tom, you and I will do another pod at some point very soon covering the offseason and draft and rumors and everything that's going on. That'll come up very soon. But Tom, appreciate you doing these pods with me during the entire playoffs and regular season. And yeah, here we are. We get a champion, the Oklahoma City Thunder. Thanks, Tom.
You got it, man. I'm pumped and jacked to be here as always. And we'll talk soon.
Thank you to everybody for listening or viewing today's stream. We streamed live on YouTube, X, TikTok, Facebook. Appreciate you all tuning in live. If you listen to the podcast afterwards, thanks for tuning in throughout this entire NBA regular season and playoffs. We'll be back again throughout the week. Got a lot happening. Draft right around the corner. Live show on Wednesday. Second round on Thursday. Free agency trades. We got it all on here. Have a good day.